Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, there's no summer school this year for kids in Bakersfield. Teachers and the superintendent weigh in. And in Fresno County, a residential facility aims to fill in some mental health treatment gaps. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Alice Daniel. It's a big week for the arts in Fresno, with an opera performance at Fresno State and the colorful Rogue Fest happening across the city.
But first, we're going to take you to Bakersfield, to the Mesa Verde Detention Facility. Its contract is about to expire. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez found while most immigration advocates want it shut down, there are benefits to having it right here in the Valley.
Monica, come in.
Hi.
Tony Amaranti opens the door to his home in Bakersfield. It's about an 8-minute drive to the Mesa Verde Detention Facility, where he's volunteered on occasion.
Come on, you can walk down my filthy house now.
Inside, he walks me down a hallway.
This is my kid's old room.
There's a nightstand in between two twin beds, and remnants of a teenager's life, a lava lamp, and a Legal Legends poster. Amaranti worries about Mesa Verde detainees who have been released, so this empty room comes in handy.
I've had three asylum seekers stay here. I'm happy to offer them some shelter and a bathroom and get them on the bus or the airplane or wherever we gotta go.
His last guest was here just last week.
Young man, an asylum seeker, and he had to get on a plane to Chicago. Poor kid doesn't speak any English. Kids from El Salvador. He's got a small child, too, and he was separated from the baby at the border.
But his work with asylum seekers may end if Mesa Verde closes. The city of McFarland's contract to run the facility under the Immigration and Customs Enforcement expires March 19th. ICE needs a city or county contract to run a facility like this. And a new state law, SB 29, says for-profit detention centers can't start a new contract.
We're all sort of like on eggshells.
That's Amber Tovar. She's an attorney for the UFW Foundation in Bakersfield.
Waiting for that email, waiting for that call that's going to tell us that we know something of what's going to happen so that we then know how do we prepare the people that we meet with.
Just last week, California Attorney General Javier Becerra released a report detailing the poor conditions inside the 10 detention facilities in the state. Detainees aren't allowed outside enough, there's limited access to health services, and little family contact. The report also says it's unclear if Mesa Verde will remain open. Tovar says that's because so much is happening at the federal level.
And how these are conversations perhaps that are happening closed doors between the Department of Homeland Security and these private corporations that are running these detention centers.
If Mesa Verde closes, detainees would most likely be transferred to other facilities.
Along with our partnership with Centro Legal de la Raza, we do go there on a monthly basis and provide them with legal orientation services. So that is a service that potentially they would not have in another location if it's not available there.
The UFW Foundation estimates about 20 to 25% of the people detained in Mesa Verde are Kern County residents, and about 60% are California residents. Fresno immigration attorney Jeremy Clayson says detainees can save thousands of dollars with a local attorney.
There is a benefit to having a detention center close by. There just is. It is a benefit for immigrants to be able to visit their families who are detained, and it's a benefit to have easy access to a lawyer.
Clayson says he isn't advocating for Mesa Verde to stay open, but he says if it closed, most people would be transferred out of San Francisco's immigration court.
If having the detention center there is a quote-unquote evil thing, the silver lining in having it there is simply that Mesa Verde is within the jurisdiction of the San Francisco or the Los Angeles immigration court, and both of those courts are the most favorable immigration courts for immigrants.
And he calls it a blessing to practice immigration law within San Francisco's jurisdiction.
The judges are the most understanding and sympathetic to the plight of immigrants. They are the most understanding, in my opinion, of family dynamics.
The company that runs Mesa Verde, the GEO Group, referred me to ICE when I asked for a comment. In an emailed statement, ICE officials say, quote, ICE will continue to explore all options to continue the use of all current facilities, end quote. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
For the record, the law firm Clayson practices with, the Yara Law Group, is a corporate sponsor of Valley Public Radio. And now we're going to stay in Kern County, where many teachers and parents are upset with the Bakersfield City School District's decision to cancel summer school. Reporter Christina Lopez caught up with some teachers at a protest and later sat down with the superintendent.
A large group of mostly teachers stands outside the door of the Bakersfield City School District's board meeting last Tuesday. They're shouting, "Let us in," because there's not enough space in the boardroom for all the teachers who want to voice their concerns.
All of a sudden, we've got an authoritarian type of administration here at the district where people are excluded rather than included. I'm so disappointed.
That's educator Mary Helen Barrow. She made it inside the meeting. She's one of at least 100 people here to protest the school board's decision to cancel summer school this school year.
I'm here to plead with you to reconsider your decision to cancel summer school. Now, I understand that you say, well, attendance has dropped to about 3,000. 3,000 is more than attend some of our high schools. Give me a break. This is not acceptable.
As the meeting continues, many teachers remain inside the small lobby area outside the boardroom. Most are dressed in red for solidarity. Some stand for an entire 2 hours. Bertha Mercado Singleton is one of them. She's a dual immersion kindergarten teacher.
It's almost a joke. When you think about what the motto is for our district, where the child comes first, and they aren't demonstrating that. The children don't come first, and neither do the teachers.
She's upset that students will miss out on basic support services.
A lot of the children that come to summer school don't have that support at home. And so without summer school, they not only don't have the academic support, a lot of the kids won't even have the 2 meals that they're allowed during summer school.
Nearly 2,000 teachers from the district received a letter in late December announcing the cut, as well as other budget constraints.
It was a surprise to everyone.
That's kindergarten teacher Paloma Tucker.
I'm aware of the financial situation that's going on. You know, my opinion is that students are the reason we're here. Students are the reason we get our funding.
Teachers make about $3,300 to teach summer school for 13 days. Tucker says people rely on that extra money.
We're not paid in the summer when we're not working.
Concerned community member Revel Nichols says there's not enough time for every teacher to speak at the board meeting, so he turns to the crowd instead.
I've cut my comments because I'm speaking from the heart to my community, for my children. And I got one last question, not for them, but for you. Whose house?
Our house.
Whose house?
Our house.
After the meeting, Superintendent Doc Irvin says opening up a second room just isn't a part of the board's practices.
Do we say every time someone says, we're going to bring a large crowd, we open up the auditorium? No, we don't do that. The bottom line is, remember, it's the board's meeting in public, not the public meeting with the board.
He says summer school was postponed this year because of budget constraints affecting the district, including transportation costs, special education funding, and health insurance for teachers.
You start talking about losing people jobs, they will lose their mind. Remember, our district has not laid off any employee due to budgetary issues. So we're trying to keep our district fiscally solvent.
Although summer school won't be in session this year, Irvin says the district plans to revise it for the following year.
We're really trying to put a system in place like high-performing districts to give the kid the support, the child the support he or she needs to be successful throughout the entire year versus 13 days in the summer. He leaves June 13th, but we don't see him again on August 18th, and someone says, well, he's retained all that. Okay. But it wasn't focusing on remediation. It was a lot more enrichment.
A vote on the revisions for the 2020 summer school program is set for the end of April. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Christina Lopez.
Mental health care is a constant need here in the San Joaquin Valley, especially for those who can't afford to go elsewhere, and for those whose symptoms are tough enough to require some treatment, but not hospitalization. Last week, Fresno County opened a new crisis residential facility to house those who fall in that in-between space. I spoke about it with Dewan Utek, director of the county's Behavioral Health Department.
Our crisis residential facility is a 16-bed residential setting. This will be for people who don't quite meet the criteria for hospitalization, but for whom the team feels like setting them up with an outpatient appointment in days' time might not be successful for them, and that getting them into a housed situation will help them have the supports they need to take advantage of and engage in the services that are being offered to them. It's generally for people who are adults. Men and women will be in the facility. We expect their length of stay to run somewhere around 30 to 60 days or so. And in that setting, they will have nursing staff and therapy staff and mental health workers, including peer support staff. So people with lived experience, people who have dealt with mental illness or substance use disorders or homelessness, who will help them navigate the system in terms of getting their needs met.
And so in terms of insurance, you know, who is this for and how much does it cost?
So the residential care, crisis residential care is available to individuals in Fresno County, largely who have Medi-Cal or who are indigent. There's typically shares of cost depending on what their income is. So it could be that they pay nothing. It could be that they pay a small amount. If they have Social Security benefits, that would be coordinated with that.
Can you give some examples of what kind of health conditions would make someone appropriate for this kind of facility?
Well, you know, anyone who has a serious mental illness and the symptoms of that and their difficulty managing those symptoms have resulted in them having a crisis. And that crisis, you know, typically when someone gets placed on a 5150 or involuntary hold, the criteria for it is they are a danger to themselves, a danger to others, or what we call grave disability. Gravely disabled means that even when resources are available to them for shelter and food and health, overall health, that they are unable to take advantage of those. And so that's why we think some people will be homeless who end up in this facility. And we anticipate that it will be those really be utilized by people who have experienced more than one crisis, and despite our efforts to get them engaged in outpatient services, are struggling to maintain their stability.
And so what is life at the facility like? They're there for 30 to 60 days. I mean, what are they doing while they're there?
Well, the goal is for it to be a home-like setting, although anytime you're in any sort of licensed institutionalized setting, that's difficult. But they will have their own rooms there. There's a nice open kitchen, and they'll be helping to prepare their own meals. They'll be washing their own clothes. They will have access to things like nursing staff to assist them with managing any medications they're on. Some services and supports will be available in the residential setting, and some they'll be going to appointments just like anyone would be from their own home.
And is this available to anyone from outside Fresno County?
You know, our expectation is that we have enough need for this service that it probably won't be available outside of the county, simply because our need will be too great and the facility will be at capacity. But that's one of the things we'll be looking at, because if we are at capacity, it would certainly warrant consideration for additional facilities like this.
Yeah, and I mean, 16 beds seems small. I mean, I understand there are a lot of services that need to happen, a lot of staff, even to take care of 16 people. But is this enough even to serve the need here in Fresno County?
Well, another interesting thing about the rules around Medi-Cal is that, roughly speaking, a percentage of the care is paid for through state funds and a percentage through federal funds. And the federal government will only pay for services and facilities 16 beds or smaller. So that's why all of our inpatient facilities that are run by county operations or paid for through county operations are 16 beds or smaller. And so that's one of the conundrums, if you will, that doesn't always make sense to people who think of things in terms of economy of scale, but that's how it's set up. And particularly, I would say, if you're trying to create a home-like setting, it makes sense to have them smaller because most of us in our homes don't live with 27 people. So that plays into it as well.
And there are no other crisis residential facilities like this in Fresno, correct?
No. Many years ago, we had a crisis residential facility, and it was closed in a time of economic turmoil, we'll say, over a decade ago. And actually, where that crisis facility was operated out of was called Apollo, and that's now a housing unit for our clients.
And what's preventing the county from being able to build more of these?
Well, we actually received funding for the construction through a competitive grant process. And so we do have some funding for construction and such, but typically for that type of infrastructure, we use grants. So we certainly, if grant funding were made available, could apply for additional funds. It's very challenging. This was a ground-up construction. Oftentimes, when you're building something related to mental health, you see a lot of what we call NIMBYism, or not in my backyard, and it can be quite challenging to find locations, particularly if you're trying to create a home-like setting in the midst of a neighborhood. In this situation, we used a county-owned property, so we didn't have to deal with that. You could also select a property that you remodeled as opposed to built from the ground up, and some counties have done that. Many counties across the state have taken advantage of this grant funding to build crisis residentials, but you know, we all are dealing with the same challenges, and so we all expect that they'll be at capacity.
Okay. Well, Dewan Utecht, Director of the Fresno County Behavioral Health Department, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Late in 2018, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a complaint against the Visalia Unified School District for violating the 1964 Civil Rights Act. According to the ACLU, African American students said their white peers referred to them as slaves and joked about hanging them from trees. Well, two reporters from the Visalia Times-Delta decided to look back at the city's racially charged past, starting with the Ku Klux Klan convention in 1931. I spoke with reporters James Ward and Callie Cedarloff. So you start your story in 1931 when more than 500 Ku Klux Klan members from all over the state came to Visalia for the annual convention. And the Visalia Times-Delta covered the story. What surprised you about the reporting?
I was really shocked about the uncritical nature of their reporting. It was reported like they were the Rotary or another legitimate civic club, like the Kiwanis Club was coming to town. It was just a really uncritical reporting. It was pretty surprising.
And when did the tone change for the newspaper? Did you compare it to later articles about the Klan?
Yeah, I think probably the tone started to change in the early to mid-70s.
Okay, so not until then.
Right. There was not much Klan coverage we could find in the 50s or 60s, really.
And when they had that convention, what was the, you talked about the kind of tenor of the newspaper, but how did the town respond to the Ku Klux Klan in the 1930s?
Well, from, I'm getting this from just the coverage of the newspaper at the time. I got the impression it was just, like I said, it was like the Kiwanis Club or the Rotary Club coming to town, the National Convention of the Kiwanis Club or Rotary Club. They were really sort of treated as a legitimate social organization, really, which certainly from a 21st century perception was really quite surprising.
As I was reading the article, I was thinking you can look at any town and find horrendous racially motivated acts throughout history. So in some ways, Visalia is not any different than any other valley town. But was there something you were looking for in particular after you realized that 1931 was when the Ku Klux Klan had their convention?
We just wanted to put these current charges by the current legal case by the ACLU in context with Visalia history and give readers a sense that these issues of race and other intolerance against other groups, and it was just not against African Americans during the history of Tulare County, just to give readers a sense of history and put these current 21st century charges in context with what would happen in the past.
Right, and you did give some other examples of intolerance against other groups, Mexicans, Armenians, Catholics.
Well, and very prominently, Dust Bowl migrants. They faced widespread discrimination in Tulare County. And of course, we mentioned the Grapes of Wrath. Much of the book is set in Tulare County and the reaction to Grapes of Wrath in the 1930s, when the late 30s, was not good. It was very negative.
So you're trying to put into context what's going on right now with the ACLU filing a complaint against the school district. By putting it in context, what are you hoping your readership will take away from it? And what about you, Callie?
I'm hoping to take a sober look at what's going on in our local school districts and what students are saying is happening, and see that there's a history here, and, you know, maybe we haven't addressed it properly in the past, but maybe we can move forward and make some changes that we're all, proud of.
Well, from your investigations over the last year, what have you learned about the school district?
I know, speaking with the district, they have been taking steps to address these problems. They have created several committees, from student committees to resident committees, local leaders, just to kind of take a look at this, take a deeper look at each claim, and really try to make those changes. I know I spoke with the superintendent on multiple occasions, and he, you know, says this is a very serious issue, and they're working towards changing it.
As recently as 1986, a Visalia auto parts business owner named Lauren Loudermilk announced he was the Grand Titan for the Ku Klux Klan in California and wanted to make Visalia the KKK's headquarters in California. So what was the reaction in the 1980s?
I think it was much different than the 1930s, when the reaction was muted. A widespread group of community activists, community members, and not just activists, community members, gathered together and organized a protest march from the College of Sequoias to downtown Visalia, and protested in front of the auto parts store. And local politicians, from the sheriff to city council members to board of supervisors, all denounced this move and Mr. Loudermilk. So the reaction was quite a bit different than from the 1930s to the mid 80s. It was dramatically different.
So it sounds like things certainly have changed from the 30s to the 80s, and the city has also done some positive things, like the local Lions Club International was the second LGBT service club in the nation following San Francisco.
One of the instances we wanted to bring in was the student in the early 2000s and late 90s who sued the school district, Visalia Unified School District. He was a gay student. He was being harassed by a teacher and other students. And they settled the lawsuit in 2002, I believe, for $230,000. And the district was required to do some sensitivity training, both for staff and teachers. And we wanted to show that, especially for the gay community in Tulare County, there has been some changes with the service club, but also the relatively new GLBT center that helps people in the gay and trans community get services, get health care, support groups. So we just wanted to show that there in that particular area, there has been some changes, especially in Visalia.
So what's the future look like for both of you in terms of race relations in Visalia?
I think it's a positive one. I mean, taking, you know, a look back where we started to where we are now, I think we've grown leaps and bounds. But speaking with students and local community members, you know, they say there's still some work to be done. So I think it's a positive one, and community members seem to be on board with making Visalia a place that welcomes everyone.
What about you, Jim?
I'm a little bit more cautious about my outlook on this because, like I said, this isn't the first time this has happened. In 2006, we had that lawsuit from the one African-American family in the last, 12 years, it seems like there hasn't been that much change. So, I'm hopeful, but I don't know what to expect. I mean, if it didn't change in the last 12 years after the last lawsuit in 2006, I'm not sure if it's going to change in the next 12, but maybe I'm a pessimist.
Visalia Times Delta reporters James Ward and Kelly Cedarloff.
This weekend, Fresno State's music department will be performing the opera Madama Butterfly. The 100-year-old show is about the convoluted marriage of an American naval officer and a Japanese geisha known as Madama Butterfly. To learn more about the performance and navigating racial stereotypes, FM89's Laura Satsui spoke to director and producer Anthony Radford, chorus master Carrie Earnhardt, and voice coach Maria Okunev-Briggs. Okunev-Briggs also plays the title role of Madama Butterfly.
This opera was written by an Italian composer, Giacomo Puccini, back in 1904. So, Tony, what makes this opera stand out even 100 years later?
I think it starts for me with the poignancy of the story, followed closely by the music. There are very few times where you can have a theatrical experience that is supported by 60 musicians, joined by singers singing the most passionate arias that are in the repertory. And that's why it's the most, I think that's why it's the most popular opera, along with La Boheme, in the world currently.
And as the chorus master, Carrie, so you're working with current students to fill out the ensemble roles. And so many of them have never sang opera before, though, but how have they responded to learning it, to learning how to sing it?
I think that they're intrigued. I think that they're excited. That's part of our job, is to get them excited about it and share some of our experiences in our own opera, experiences growing up.
I'm really curious, can anyone sing opera?
That's a very interesting question. I think that you can train anyone to do certain things in the opera. I think for opera choruses, there's a lot more flexibility.
Anytime Madama Butterfly is performed, it does bring up questions about diversity and representation. And there are moments, I think, when in some stagings, a character could become a stereotype. Butterfly may be played in as a submissive Asian woman, or Kate, the American wife, may be portrayed as a bit of a white savior figure. But Tony, how do you balance the desire to be true to what Puccini wrote, what he first staged, while not adhering to stereotypes?
Well, we come up against this question a lot in opera, because opera borrows tales from many different cultures. And what I've learned over the years is to do as much research as you can whenever you put on an opera, and treat whatever culture you're dealing with, borrowing from, because we are borrowing, we treat that from a place of honesty and respect and research, and be honest with, if we make mistakes, be open to those criticisms, and try better next time. But I think it comes down to respect and honesty when we're performing other people's, representing other people's cultures.
Maria, so you are playing, you are playing the title role of Butterfly. How did you prepare for this role?
How did I prepare? With trepidation. It's such an iconic role. It's been sung by some of the greatest singers of the century. And the music is not easy. So I try to be as detailed as possible, again, do a lot of research and learn it very slowly, very diligently, as much as I can.
What about the challenge of not being Japanese, but playing what is written as a Japanese character?
Well, I'm not going to try and be Japanese, because I'm not, obviously. Whenever you go and see an opera, whether it's Turandot, where it's set in China, or Carmen, set in Seville, which, by the way, is sung in French, or, you know, there's many, many examples. Queen of Spades set in Russia. You will almost always have singers that sing the roles will be of a completely different nationality. And so in my case, I'm a Russian-born soprano who grew up in Australia and moved to US, singing this Japanese character in Italian, written by an Italian composer. So it's I feel like a very international person doing that, but also people coming to opera need to be prepared to have the suspense of disbelief, to enjoy the opera. If you're not prepared to take that leap, I don't think you will enjoy it very much. I think when we come and see any piece of theater, that has to happen. So and Tchaikovsky said, people criticize opera, but you can't expect the opera to be a realistic piece of drama or like a documentary, because people in their right mind and people who are kind of balanced don't break out into song to say something. Yeah.
Being that this is, as you mentioned, this is kind of almost like an international thing. It's an Italian, it's an opera sung in Italian, written by an Italian composer, but about a romance between an American and a Japanese woman. So I guess, how do you translate that story to people when it's maybe not in a language that they understand and it's singing? How do you do that?
Well, practically, we put the translation up above the stage in super titles. So the audience will be able to read the language in English. So that's practically how we do it. We also hope that that the audience will be able to read the plot in their programs before it happens, if they're unfamiliar with it. But this piece also exists in other forms in our culture. Miss Saigon, if they've gone and seen Miss Saigon, that will be a very familiar plot to them. So there are a number of ways that we help.
We also have a pre-opera talk, given by our musicology professor, John Carr. So I think it's a very good idea for pieces like that to have a sort of a small lecture that precedes a performance, because that really helps people. And if they have questions at the time, they can also ask them.
It'd be an hour before.
Mm-hmm. An hour before, yeah.
And then briefly from you all, what is most exciting to you about this performance, about even putting this on in the first place? Carrie, let's start with you.
I think one of the coolest things about it is you have the director of choral activities, our two lead voice professors, the head of our orchestral department, and one of our musicologists all working together with our student body. And I think that that's really exciting and something unique that you don't find on a lot of university campuses. So that way our students get the best of all of us, I think, in that setting. So I think that is, for me, one of the most exciting aspects of it.
For me, it's bringing to Fresno something that doesn't often get done here, which is a large-scale opera with a large-scale orchestra, with professional singers in a very intimate setting. We are right on top of the audience, and there aren't very many. There's 300 seats, so it is exciting and electric, and bringing it to this community is a real pleasure.
I think all the main points have been covered. I agree with everything. I think also it's very exciting to see our students rise up to the challenge, not just the singers, but the orchestra, because the score is very challenging. And when you hear them play, they play like the London Symphony. They're amazing. And to see everything come together and see our students succeed in putting this on, and not just musically, but also with their assignments in directing. We have a student director, we have students doing costumes, we have students doing props and sets and publicity, and they're doing a really great job, and that's exciting for me as well.
Wonderful. We have been talking to Dr. Tony Radford, Dr. Maria Briggs, and Dr. Carrie Earnhardt, all faculty at Fresno State's Music Department, putting on Madama Butterfly this upcoming weekend. Thank you all for taking the time.
Thank you.
Happy Fat Tuesday, everyone. It's a great day to indulge. And we're going to indulge you right now with a preview of one of the longest-running fringe festivals in the world. Fresno's Rogue Fest. There's theater, music, dance, and even magic. And it's happening this week in the Tower District. Today, we have three special guests live in our studio. Marcel Nunes, the founder of Rogue, Heather Parrish, a longtime Fresno performer, and Donna Kay Yarborough, a returning performer from Portland, Oregon. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks. So, Marcel, what exactly is a fringe festival?
Well, we'll have to go back into history. In 1947, it started off in Edinburgh as the Edinburgh Arts Festival. There were several groups who were locked out of the festival. So they said, yeah, well, we'll do a festival anyway. And so it was on the fringe of the main festival. And that's how the Fringe Festival was born.
And now there's a huge one there, right?
Yeah. Actually, there are like three or four ongoing. There's the Fringe of the Fringe. Mm-hmm.
And the Fringe of the Fringe of the Fringe.
Yes.
But there are fringe festivals all over the world now.
And you're the brainchild of Rogue. So tell us, how did this crazy festival get started here?
I would go up to San Francisco to the Fringe Festival there and catch shows. We've taken shows up to the San Francisco Fringe. And after a while, some of the people in my theater group said, hey, let's start a festival here.
Mm-hmm.
And being the narcissist and masochist that I am.
Right. It takes both of those, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the festival's done really well here in Fresno. Are you surprised by that?
Yes and no. Early days, we didn't know what. In fact, the first festival that we had, it was going to be a one-off, and it depended on audience support. And I had a magic number. If it surpassed that magic number, then we could continue.
And it did. Heather, you're a longtime performer at Rogue and the former executive director. Mm-hmm. The festival is non-juried. Can you tell us what that means for artists like you and the audience?
Yes. It means that basically there's nobody who is a gatekeeper. We choose people through a lottery system where they put in an application, we give them a random number, and then we choose them randomly. And so that means that there's nobody saying, hey, this show is inappropriate, or this show doesn't meet the quality standards, or this show is not right for this community. So that gives artists the opportunity to present exactly what they feel inside their souls, inside their brains, to the world without somebody saying, no, you're not right for this.
Right. So there's no judgment as to whether it's good or bad.
Correct. And we're also a non-juried festival, which means that we only give one award, which is the sold out award. Did you get butts in the seats?
And who's sold out so far?
Actually, Jaguar Bennett's Jaguar Saves America. He has sold out both of his first two shows, mostly, I think, because people found out that other people were walking out of his shows because they were so
controversial.
It's a politics show, so it's controversial. Who else has sold out? I can't remember.
Eulogy has sold out.
Yeah. And he's another traveling fringe performer who's a guest in town. And Lark, which is a Celtic music group from here in Fresno.
Right. So you have performers from all over, not just in Fresno. I'm curious, what does it take to put this festival together? There's a lot of coordinating, a lot of volunteering,
yes,
bringing people in.
We generally eventually book about 50 different acts in about 7 different official venues and then another 4 or 5 BYOV, Artist Underground venues, which the artists control. And so we need the artists to come in with their art. We coordinate about 100 different volunteers in different aspects, from the staff down to the ticket tables. And then we need the audiences to show up.
And how do you find volunteers?
Well, most of them are recruited from people who come to the shows that are interested in becoming more involved. And a lot of them are from the arts community around Fresno as well.
So, Donna,
yes,
you've been on the edge of the Fringe circuit, and you've been coming here for several years. What's unique about Rogue in comparison to other Fringe festivals?
Well, I will tell you this, that the rumbles amongst those that tour the Fringe circuit, everybody just kind of knows that Rogue is one of the friendliest festivals out there. It's very, very early in the year. So not only is the community very welcoming and very supportive, a lot of people have discovered that this is a fantastic place to launch new shows. As a matter of fact, all four of the shows I'm performing this year, Blatant Self-Promotion, have had their initial run in a Fringe Festival here at Rogue Festival.
So Rogue's a friendly festival.
It is a very friendly festival, and it is a quality festival, too. It is, especially in the fairness, as Heather can speak more on, it's about 50% local folks and 50% traveling folks. And it is, you will see some high-quality, very experienced artists on the stage here.
Well, speaking of performances, why don't we go around and why don't you tell me what shows you're performing? I know you're performing for Donna. And yeah,
yes.
Give us a little preview of what you're doing.
Well, I have brought back a show from 2 years ago. It's called Query the Crone. I'm doing it at the Tent of Tales, sponsored by Mad Productions, which is actually in Marcel's backyard. And it's an immersive, interactive storytelling show where I'm the wise woman of the woods and the audience has come to me for wisdom, and we do a lot of interaction. It's a very friendly interaction. People don't have to be scared by that. A second show is the one I did last year called Diagnose This, Tales of a Medical Actor, which is my real stories about my work as a standardized patient, aka medical actor, that helps healthcare students learn to do what they do. The brand new one this year is called Klondike Kate's Sourdough Reunion Show. And it's about a true historical figure, a woman named Kathleen Rockwell, Klondike Kate, who became a very famous showgirl in the Yukon and then retired to Oregon and turned over a farm by herself. Just amazing woman. And then I've got an experiment one called Professor Yarbrough's Lecture Hall, which is a fully improvised comedic college lecture where my notes are based on factoids that the audience has written down on note cards, and I just turn them over and read them cold and incorporate it into the lecture.
That sounds terrifying.
It is.
So Marcel, what about you?
I'm bringing back a show called Lies My Father Told Me. I've done this like 3 times before. And the whole series of stories that my dad had told me when I was growing up. And I've kind of strung them together in a show.
And you're performing in your backyard?
In my backyard, in the Tent of Tales. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that. This is a new thing that Rogue is doing.
Yes, Rogue Underground is something that started last year. And what it does is it affords artists who did not get into the Rogue the regular way.
Mm-hmm. By lottery.
To find their own venues and to manage their own venues, basically. So that's part of what Rogue Underground is, yeah.
And how many venues are there for the Rogue Underground? Several?
I think three
actually,
venues.
I think that there's four.
Four venues, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's up from one from last year.
Yeah.
So.
And those artists don't get sort of the Rogue support. In other words, they don't have volunteers working with
them,
right?
They don't have box office support or tech support or anything like that.
They do it all themselves.
They do it all themselves. But they are listed in the Rogue program, and they are treated just like any other Rogue artists, as opposed to the pariahs we are.
The advantage that they have is that they get to control their own money. They don't have to worry about anybody else giving them their paycheck on time. They get to control their own times, so they get to have 8 o'clock times if they want the whole time. So whatever they feel like is best for their shows.
2 a.m., whatever.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Like, for instance, all my shows at 7 p.m.
And that works well for you.
That works well for me. Yeah.
Okay, Heather, what about you?
I'm directing a show called Swill, Drunk Shakespeare, and it is actually Drunk Shakespeare. We get about half the cast drunk, and they do a condensed version of Romeo and Juliet in the Tower Theater Lounge. And my other show, the one that I'm actually appearing in, is called Tea Liturgy, which is a music and storytelling show about the creative process.
Okay, and let's segue now to you perhaps doing a little bit of that, right? You're going to read a little bit of Tea Liturgy?
Yeah, I might have a minute or two, if that's
okay,
all right.
Okay, share that with us. Thank you.
We call it Tea Liturgy because we've actually structured it a bit like a liturgy in a worship service, but it is not religious in any way, shape, or form. So this is from my homily. For the last year, I've been in a transition phase, coming out of arts administration with the Rogue Festival and back into the creative world. I was seeking small projects to guide me back to my creative voice. I had been feeling at sea, separate from my inner world and from my passion for living a creative life. So when Victor and I met at Goldstein's to discuss my joining Ardor Evidence as the writer element, I was enthusiastic. I looked forward to writing with some purpose, to working in collaboration with new people, to get my optimism about being a creative artist jump-started again. It was after the second session when phrases like songwriting and singing and backup vocals started coming into the conversation more and more that a new and suspicious thought crept into my consciousness. I went home and said to my husband, "Well, babe, it seems I accidentally joined a band." In my theatrical world, working collaboratively with musicians means talking dramatically while making some sort of soundscape happening behind you. I don't know why I didn't pick up on the fact that they're all musicians, and to musicians, music is going to be a pretty central part of the deal. But I didn't. But at that point, I decided to roll with it. Sure, I hadn't sung a note in public since middle school, but who cares? I hadn't attempted anything musical in over 30 years, no problem. We're not counting that weird production of Hair I directed in 2010. I'm a smart, competent, creative person, right? I ran the Rogue Festival, for crying out loud. I should be able to handle this. So I showed up every week. I took notes. I kept the show Bible. I made observations. I offered suggestions. I participated in the producing tasks. I even sat down with a glass of wine and RhymeZone.com and wrote some verses for a song. Every Monday night meeting would come, and I'd say to myself, 80% of a creative life is showing up. Showing up in the room, being open to what challenges come your way, and doing the work even when you don't feel like it.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you. So, Donna,
yes.
You're also going to do a little performance for us.
Yeah, I will share a story from Diagnose This, which, again, is my work as a standardized patient. And people always wonder, what is a standardized patient? And I explain to them that when students of healthcare are in their early days of training, they are basically become these feral woodland creatures that are cast out into forest of knowledge, and they're just stuffing their cheeks full of information, and they clutter together for warmth, and you could tell they're really young because they haven't grown in their white coats yet. So we, as the standardized patients, are the first people they talk to that are not involved in the medical field. We're basically their rehabilitators. So they, the students, are so nervous. They will do things that they would never do if they had their wits about them. And one of my favorite experiences is the students have to be very cautious of their cleanliness. They have to wash their hands all the time. If they put on gloves, they can't touch anything. This makes sense in a healthcare environment. And one time I had a student. His name was Rami. All names have been changed to protect the innocent. His name was Rami, and he was polydactyl. He had two thumbs on one hand. It was really wonderful. And he was supposed to do a lymph node exam upon me, which means he had to palpate my neck to check the lymph nodes. And he was getting ready to do it. He was very nervous. The room was very cold. So Rami says, "I'm sorry, my hands are cold. Permit me to warm them up." And Rami goes, he breathes all over his hands, rubs them together, and then reaches to palpate my neck. So when he came back into the room, I wanted to encourage him. So I said, "Rami, it is absolutely wonderful that you cared enough about the comfort of the patient to warm your hands. Did you know you did that handy, breathy, rubby thing?" And he was mortified. He was so nervous that not only did he not know he did that, but he didn't realize that he could have just warmed his hands in the sink that was 2 feet away from him.
Right, something a little cleaner.
Right, but it wasn't a total hand wash, so to speak. At the end of it, I told him that his thumb was a wonderful way to get you to know your patients, the polydactyl thumb. And he looks at me very sheepishly and he goes, "You want to touch it?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to touch it," which would be inappropriate in any other situation. But I figure if I get to touch a polydactyl thumb in a non-creepy manner, I'm doing something right.
So are you going to give us the... Was that it?
That was part of it.
Okay, that was part of
that
it.
That was part of the show. That's how natural and
that
casual
was very
the
natural.
Show is.
I didn't know if you were setting us up.
That would be the longest setup in public radio history.
You know, that's what happens in radio, right?
Yeah.
There are often long setups. But thank you. I loved that.
You're welcome.
I'm never going to look at hands the same way.
Yes.
Especially medical doctor's hands.
Always clean. Always clean.
Okay, so what's the worst show you've ever seen at a Fringe Festival?
I think Marcel and I came to a consensus on this. It was a show from several years back called Santa's Basement.
Yeah.
Well, the name already sounds creepy.
Well, yeah, and I think it was intended to be something of a creepy show, but it wasn't creepy done right.
Yeah.
And so why was
that
it so awful?
Sometimes. Marcel?
It was ill-rehearsed, ill-written, ill-conceived, that performers were not very good.
Yeah.
And I think that says it all.
It would just sort of hit all the boxes for bad.
Which sometimes happens at Rogue,
yeah,
right? You've got
right.
some bad shows
One
and some good shows.
One of the things about being, you know, a lottery system is that, yeah, you can go from seeing a show that just blows you away to the next show being the worst thing that you've ever seen.
To a show that just blows.
Yes, yes, exactly.
What percentage of the shows this year do you think are really good?
Well, I mean, as the promo person, I have to say all of them. But
okay, let's pretend you're not the promo person.
On a general thing, I always say that there's probably 85 to 90% of the shows that have a worthwhile element on some level. There's only about 10% that I would be like, no, don't go see that. So, you know.
You're taking your chances.
Yeah, but it is also only an hour. And the cost is low.
Right. All the shows are just an hour.
Yes.
So quickly, we have a little bit of time left. If you've never been to Rogue before, what advice are you going to give this person? I've never been to Rogue before. Tell me, what should I do?
Well, pick the program first.
Find a program. Yeah.
Yeah. Pick a show that looks interesting to you. Turn up to that. And right after that show, go to the next thing on a whim.
So just keep going.
Yes.
Take some chances.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can get set up at your first place. Find a show, get to a table, grab a program, get your wristband, take your tickets in, and try two shows before you make up your mind.
And there's a lot of synergy among performers at Rogue, isn't there?
Yes, there is. We're very close, a lot of us. And people, when they come in new for the first time, I believe we really make an effort to reach out to them and bring mm-hmm. them in and make them feel at home. Mm-hmm. And it helps for the performers to have a better performance as well, because a lot of these people, this is their living, and it just reinforces them and helps them be stronger in that case.
And how many more performances do you have, Donna?
I have one more performance of Diagnose This, one performance of Query the Crone, two more performances of Klondike Kate's Sourdough Reunion Show, and then the one last day performance of Professor Yarbrough's Lecture Hall.
And then you can finally sleep.
Yes, for a few days.
Okay, well, a big thanks to all of you for coming out to the studio, and good luck with the rest of the festival.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Alice Daniel, and reporters Monica Velez and Laura Satsui. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.